Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 15th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. The annual Susan G. Komen Pink Ribbon Luncheon will be held Thursday, October 3rd from 11:30 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale. Proceeds from this luncheon and silent auction will benefit Komen Ozark. Tickets and more information available at komenozark.org or 750-PINK.
Ahead on Weekend Ozarks, it's never too early or too late to start thinking about retirement. Three things you need to know about saving.
Plus, Becca Martin Brown tells us what's up and talk like a pirate. You can do that in our Sunday morning montage.
But first, there was lots of news about building this week, but not just bricks and mortar. Building for the future. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
Early voting began this week in Bentonville for a proposed millage increase for Bentonville Public Schools. If approved by voters in the school district, the 2.9 mil increase would fund construction of a second high school in the district, which would serve about 2,250 students. Mary Lay, the school district's director of communications, says that the current high school serves about 4,200 students and that classroom space is scarce.
We have 65 teachers on carts right now, and that's very significant. That means they don't have a classroom that they roam all day from one teacher that has a planning period to the next teacher that has a planning period, and without their environment and preparation time, that's really hurts them. It makes it more complicated for them. We want to keep the best and the brightest teachers and not put them in those kind of situations. And to put that in perspective, Central Park is our largest elementary school. They have 805 students and 55 full-time teachers, so we have more teachers on carts than our largest elementary school has on staff.
Lay says that with continued growth in the district, a failed millage increase this time could mean the introduction of more portable classrooms or split schedules, or even state intervention, meaning that the school's operating budget would be cut in order to fund construction of a new facility. This is the third proposed millage increase for a second high school in 5 years. Lay says that this time, she feels that voters will be supportive of the school district's request.
I'm confident that we listened. I'm confident that we have the most affordable package without lessening the quality of education. I'm confident that the way we're sharing athletics is the fair thing to do, and yet we could still have good programs. I'm confident that we're taking care of the needs of our students. So I feel like we have done due diligence to take care of our community, and I really believe in our people in our community, and I believe they will support us.
Election day is Tuesday, and Lee says that voters should double-check where their precinct is, as some polling places have changed. To find your voting location, visit voterview.org. The future site of the U.S. Marshals Museum in Fort Smith has moved slightly. Last week, the museum board approved a plan to move the museum about 2,000 feet north from the original site location. Pat Mickle of the Fort Smith-based engineering firm of Mickle Wagner Coleman says that the plan to move the site came after a land use assessment of the Westfall property along the Fort Smith riverfront, which included the original museum site.
In combination with things we were hearing about, the kinds of volumes, like, for example, the Crystal Bridges, that their attendance level was much, much higher than they originally anticipated is. To some degree, the same thing was happening with the Clinton Library. We looked at the Marshals Museum site and saw a site that was a great location in a lot of respects, but was hemmed in because of river on one side, city park on one side, highway on one side, gas well on a fourth side. They were kind of hemmed in for spaces. And if there was an opportunity or a need for growth in the future, they were pretty well in a difficult spot.
But Mickle says that the new site, which is further downriver on the Westfall property, where there hasn't been nearly as much development to date, is twice as large, with 16 acres total, and it's also twice as deep and at least 15% wider. He says that the larger lot gives site planners different opportunities for development. Additionally, with the original site, Mickle says that the museum building would have been right against easement lines and close to a required setback from Riverfront Drive. And though a zoning plan has not yet been completed for the riverfront, Mickle says that several uses for adjoining properties are being explored.
What we're looking at is potentially a hotel-type uses. We are looking for, we would think it would be an ideal site for a corporate office type, some kind of multi-structure office building. Could even be for condominium-type use, multifamily stuff. But also, we see other uses associated with the city's growth, as the city has a park just to the up Riverside of the site is they have a river pavilion there, and beyond that they have an amphitheater and at Kelly Park. Some uses that would be associated with those kinds of uses, some more public-type uses.
He says that regardless of what is built along the riverfront, there will be restrictions against structures being built that will block the view of the river from other developments. And completion of the Bella Vista bypass has hit a bump in the road. Missouri highway officials informed Arkansas highway officials earlier in the week that funding for their portion of the bypass north of the state line has come up short. But Randy Ort of the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department says that the commitments are still in place for construction of the bypass, but the remaining question is when the money will come through. Until that point, Ort says that construction of the full interchange near McKissick Creek would be delayed.
Until the Bella Vista bypass is totally completed, all the way through Arkansas up to Pineville, Missouri, we don't want that traffic pattern to change. So what we are proceeding with at this point is a temporary usable connection there at McKissick Creek. In other words, just a part of the ultimate interchange. And we're going to continue with the initial two-lane construction over to match up with what is already under construction right now around Hiawassee up to County Road 34. We're also not going to proceed north from County Road 34 until we get a timing commitment from Missouri.
Ort says that part of Missouri's funding is still allocated to the project, but Missouri highway officials opted against a partial construction in favor of building all of their stretch at once.
With the terrain up there, the type of work that they're going to be doing, they are not going to proceed with just a partial contract or anything like that. They want to wait till they have full funding.
Ort says that the $100 million allocated for the two lanes of the Arkansas stretch of the bypass will remain allocated to the project. However, Ort said that highway commissioners this week took another look at a toll study commissioned for the stretch of highway.
It now appears that it may be more feasible to move forward with the additional two lanes sooner rather than later and to build them as a free facility rather than as a toll facility. There's many moving pieces and moving parts all the time on this. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle. But that appears to be the best direction to go. Of course, the commission has some tough decisions to make in future meetings, but we're committed, and there's no question about completing the initial two lanes. It's just looking much more promising that we'll be able to go ahead and complete all four rather than just the initial two.
The additional two lanes would cost about $51 million to build, and like the rest of the future Interstate 49, it's a matter of when rather than if it will be built. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Remember as a child going to the school nurse when you felt ill. She would comfort you until your mom came to pick you up. Public schools still employ registered nurses, but as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, several dozen Arkansas districts now also operate school-based health and wellness centers.
It's quiet this Monday morning at the Lincoln Public School District Wellness Center, with just one little boy receiving care. But over a span of 3 years since the center opened, lots of kiddos have been helped, says Superintendent Mary Ann Spears.
And we do all kinds of things. We have a doctor that comes in. We have dental services that come in. We have counseling, school site-based counseling for our students. And then we have a psychiatrist that comes in and does meds for kids that need that as well.
And the need is great here because 72% of students qualify for free or reduced lunch. Newly hired social worker Crystal Pitts helps coordinate treatment and conducts individual and group counseling in the center's private counseling quarters.
So the referral process is that counselors will receive referrals from teachers or faculty, and then they will send them to me if they need further services than what the counselor can provide. So then I'll refer them out to either myself or OGC or Methodist Family.
OGC is Ozark Guidance, based in Springdale, and Methodist Family Health is based in Little Rock. people at their comprehensive behavioral health care providers. Lincoln School District Wellness Center staff described the place as a one-stop shop for medical services, including food insecurity intervention. Of course, parents must consent to such care. Faculty and staff refer students to the center, where they will meet Director Marty Kauser at intake. She gives us a quick tour, starting with the center's dental office.
We had a dentist that had committed, but that has since fallen through, so we're going to try chasing someone different now. And so we're working on this piece. The next room over is where we have our snack pack for kids program. And every Friday we send out bags of food that can cover most of their needs for the weekend. We have a lot of hygiene products we get donated from United Way. And so we use those just about every day. All the schools in the district can come and use this closet. And then we have a psychiatrist that comes every other week on a Wednesday. Her office is here. And then Dr. Deer is our MD that comes, and she comes once a week on Tuesdays. And these are the exam rooms that she uses.
The center provides preventive health care as well as eye care.
We do the vision hearing screenings here at school that they do at every school. However, there are a lot of the kids that need glasses that can't get transportation. So a lot of times we will transport to Fayetteville Eye Center, get what they need there.
When it first opened 3 years ago, the center operated out of a very small renovated house where group therapy had to be conducted in the laundry room. But since the new high school was built off campus, the center found new spacious quarters in part of the old high school building. Director Marty Kauser first started here when the district was awarded its first wellness center grant, $175,000, 3 years ago.
Which covered salaries of the workers here and then supplies and some travel. Now we're on what they call the extension grant, which will decrease in funding over the next 3 years. And we're on $100,000 this year, and it will decrease to $80,000 and then down to $70,000. And by that time, we need to have found our sustainability to maintain the clinic on our own.
The center gets 20% of providers' billings, which is either private insurance or our kids, the state's Children's Medicaid Fund, with typically no out-of-pocket costs for patients' families. And physician Dr. Deer comes once a week.
Right now, that is fulfilling our needs. She comes for the morning hours on Tuesdays, and we are able to give her a pretty full schedule each Tuesday. Anything that might cross over through a weekend, we can call her, and she works them in at her clinic before the weekend comes, because her clinic is locally, and we can transport those kids there if needed.
But the center also operates at a significant loss, given 50% or more of patients' families are working poor, so earn too much for Medicaid, but too little to afford private health insurance. So staff provide their care for free.
A lot of times there's one vehicle per family. The father's working in Fayetteville or Springdale or Rogers, and the mother has no way of getting the children to a physician. So that's why we really had the need to have on-site services so that we can see them 5 days a week.
But come October, many working poor families will, for the first time, be able to enroll in subsidized private health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And if school-based wellness centers are listed on insurance providers' plan, those centers will likely see a boost in billable income. Lincoln Wellness Center staff meet once a year with other school-based health centers in Little Rock. To date, 21 Arkansas districts have received startup grants, says Tamara Baker, statewide coordinator based at the Arkansas Department of Health. ADH works in partnership on the centers with the Arkansas Department of Education.
The funding came through in 2000 based on a 2009 legislation, tobacco excise tax in Arkansas. And those tax dollars went into the general fund to fund five or six different health initiatives. And we were kind of a small piece of that, but we were a piece of that excise tax that came through in 2009. So our first funded schools really got it, and we put out that RFA pretty quick. So we have just starting our fourth year.
Tamara Baker says the grant program is really competitive because all Arkansas school districts want wellness centers.
Priority points are given to schools, and I need to get that in front of me. There's priorities for if you live in a red county, which is a county with some health disparities, going on, and they have high poverty, and there's several different ways schools can get priority points to reach those populations that need it the most. And the idea is to get quality health care to children that aren't getting health care.
Nearly 2,000 school-based health centers operate across the U.S., according to a National Assembly on School-Based Healthcare Census. And just last year, the Affordable Care Act provided $14.5 million in capital grants to 50 districts nationwide to expand their centers. And Lincoln School District Wellness Center Director Marty Kauser says she's clearly seeing a difference among her students.
I can't really put a number to the people that we see that are more well than they used to be, but we can absolutely put a number to how much more they are in school. Their academics are better, their attendance is better. We see all these things improve since we've come here to the campus.
But more important, student well-being is clearly on the rise, she says.
They see me in the hall and they just give me a hug. They've received clothes from us. They've received vaccines from us. They receive food every week from us. Anytime they're sick, they come see Dr. Deer. And they're just happier kids for it. I've seen such a difference. And if they are in counseling, the counselors can always comment on, these are just different kids than we saw before. And it's such a blessing. You know, that's what we're here for, is to try to make their lives better.
The Lincoln School District Wellness Center would like to make the entire campus better by someday conveying medical, mental, and preventive health care services to faculty and staff. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Later today on This American Life, 30 years ago, Bill was on the phone with his dad when a strange sound came on the line.
Just a ping, like every 5 seconds.
That's funny. Maybe we're being eavesdropped on. Sometimes I wonder if this phone is tapped.
It was Bill's father, Seagrew, recording the calls. And what Bill heard on those tapes decades later changed what he thought he knew. Not about his father, but about himself. Later today.
This American Life, just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock, here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
There's a really nice loft bedroom, and then a little kitchen over here. And
air conditioning.
Air conditioning, heating, and a bathroom with a shower.
And a bell.
And a bell.
Not every art gallery has on-site living premises for visiting artists, complete with a bell, but almost everything about the new gallery Bottle Rocket is intended to be different than other galleries. It's not located near a downtown, and for the first year at least, it will feature exclusively out-of-state artists, and the featured works are expected to challenge patrons, probably even alienate some. And all of this is wrapped up in a certain degree of whimsy, starting with the name Bottle Rocket.
So you use champagne bottles to, what do you say?
How
do you
say?
Christen a boat, right? We christen Bottle Rocket Gallery by shooting bottle rockets. We're going to shoot fireworks at every opening. We just want to be wild. We want our openings to be wild.
And be super fun.
Yes. Super fun.
Kat Wilson and Sarah Leffler are serious about art and serious about having fun, and it seems always passionate about what they're doing. They're formally launching Bottle Rocket on Friday, September 20th, with the opening of the gallery's first show. Both are artists themselves, Kat, a photographer, and Sarah works in three-dimensional media, and they're pouring time, sweat, and money into developing a type of gallery they say isn't quite represented in Northwest Arkansas just yet. Even the location sets it apart. Bottle Rocket is located inside Fayetteville city limits, but barely. Nestled inside a thicket almost in Farmington, the main gallery is a small cabin built by Robert Runyon that blends a simple floor plan with incredible craftsman touches. Sarah Leffler, who lives in a house just a few hundred feet away from the cabin, says the space wasn't made to be a gallery, but it seems to be an appropriate use.
The story is it started out as a chicken coop, but as Robert designed it and built it, it became clear that it was way too beautiful, and even too beautiful to be like working studio space. So the space becomes more important because of the beauty of the building, and I think it'll be good foil for all kinds of contemporary art.
From inside the cabin, you can see only trees. But a Walmart Supercenter is within walking distance. Kat Wilson, Sarah Leffler's partner in the Bottle Rocket, says she can imagine a time when a visiting artist will expand their canvas beyond the cabin.
We want to bring in some land artists to utilize the space around here because it is amazing space. I mean, if we walked back there, you'd be like, wow, I can't even believe that I can walk to Walmart from here.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I think we can bring in some land artists.
I think it would be a great, very inspiring installation site for people who, you know, install in nature.
Spend just an hour with Kat and Sarah, and you'll hear the phrase, "That could be part of an installation," about a half dozen times. Their unbridled enthusiasm extends to the visiting artists they'll bring in. By their own description, they're seeking artwork that is controversial, confrontational, or in some way challenging for the viewer. The first artist invited for an exhibit is Logan Rollins, a photographer who lives in West Virginia, who says his work explores the ideas of gay identity. He creates what he calls makeshift theater. Sarah Loeffler says the images are of people who choose costumes that instantly draw attention.
He describes his work as being based in an anti-aesthetic, a sort of against a lot of elaboration and effort put into making something look beautiful. And the irony is the pictures are beautiful. I mean, there's no other word to describe them. When you see these pictures, they've got complexity and depth.
Logan Rollins will be at the September 20th opening of his show. Other artists booked for the season create art that confronts ideas about race and society. In all, there will be 5 shows this season, and the curators want to give the artists something beyond just exposure, money. The plan is to give each selected artist a stipend of $1,000.
The reason we're asking for money is so that we can pay the artists, because they deserve to be paid. Even if, you know, we might beg enough for them to come for free, and we might be able to find people who would come for free. I think this is important.
We're limiting ourselves, so we really want to. We're really going to try hard to earn the money.
Yep. And the other thing is, you'd be surprised at how many actually very well known artists are excited about the idea of a stipend. So we've got
and coming to Fayetteville, Arkansas.
And coming to Fayetteville, exactly.
Bottle Rocket is a nonprofit endeavor, and Sarah and Kat are using the crowdsourcing website Kickstarter to help fund their plan. Launched late last month, the Kickstarter project seeks $6,000, $5,000 for the stipends for each artist, and an additional $200 for publicity and printing for each show. Visiting artists will be asked to stick around Fayetteville in northwest Arkansas for a few days after the opening. That won't cost anything, because artists will be able to stay on the grounds inside that adapted 19th century barn.
And one reason why they need to stay around for a few days is we're also going to make sure that they give an artist talk, and the venue may be the University of Arkansas Fine Arts Department.
The Underground
has expressed interest in sponsoring an artist talk, but we'll want them to be here for a few days so that they can talk to the community and explain what might be difficult work for some people.
The idea of connecting visiting artists to the community on this land isn't new. In fact, there is an amazing synchronicity developing on this piece of land on Finger Road. Charles J. Finger, a British-born writer, came to the land in the 1920s. He was a prolific writer and highly respected. He won the 1925 Newbery Medal for his book Tales from Silver Lands. He would often bring speakers, artists, and writers to Fayetteville and have them engage in community-wide discussions, often on the very land Bottle Rocket Gallery occupies.
People like Carl Sandburg and other writers and artists, and they would have these sort of salons at the house, and people from the university would come. And this was hugely important to him and to the community.
Though this is just the opening season for Bottle Rocket, Kat Wilson and Sarah Loeffler have not stopped thinking about what could be in the gallery's future. There isn't just the main gallery and the modified barn. There's also a small white cottage used by Charles Finger's daughter, Helen, as an art studio, which, of course, Kat thinks,
which is potentially a great place for an installation.
Yes. Yeah, awesome place for an installation. Or maybe if we have a kind of rugged and outdoorsy type, they could stay down there. There's no bathrooms. They may want to, but there is a fireplace.
The opening reception for the first Bottle Rocket hosted show is Friday, September 20th at the gallery at 1495 Finger Road in Fayetteville, just off of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The reception will feature live music and the artist Logan Rollins, and is open to the public. You can learn more about the gallery's Kickstarter project online at Kickstarter.com. Just enter the words Bottle Rocket into the site's search engine. This is Ozarks at Large.
An investor education series focusing on individuals thinking about retirement will take place the next three Thursdays at the Fayetteville Public Library. How Can I Afford Retirement is presented, in part, by the Garrison Financial Institute at the University of Arkansas's Sam M. Walton College of Business. I recently spoke with the Institute's managing director, Dr. Craig Rainey, who says the program's target audience is Baby Boomers Plus, ages 50 to 70. I noted that the target audience is awfully close to retirement.
Some actually are, but that's true. Again, what we're really focused on is people that are thinking about retirement and, so say a 50-year-old. It could be of interest to somebody in their 20s or 30s that's at the early stages. And, of course, the sooner you begin planning for saving and investing for retirement, the more painless it's going to be and probably the better off you're going to be in retirement. And also for, say, people at 70, it's an issue of not outlasting your retirement assets.
I know that I don't necessarily fit into this age group, but, I mean, at 32, I mean, I have to start thinking about it now.
Now, I thought you were about 29, but in any case, actually, the sooner you start, as I say, the more painless it's going to be and probably the better off that you're going to be when you are in retirement. The ideal age, actually, I was talking to my students last night. I wish I had started when I was one or perhaps even before I was born. That would be the ideal time. And that's because of the power of compounding growth. It could be in dividends. It could be on price appreciation, that is, say, stock returns or returns on your bonds from capital appreciation. Bonds go up and down in price, too, just like stocks or other kinds of assets. And actually, Albert Einstein described the power of compounding growth as the single most powerful force in the universe. That applies in the case of investments as well.
All right. What is the most important thing that somebody needs to know?
Well, I understand the series here is about the three things
right.
People need to know. So I was thinking carefully about that. And I think the three things people need to know is, first of all, information, or think about this as education. They have to know about the issues surrounding retirement. Typically, people don't save and invest nearly enough in the investments they make. There's some issues with that. So people tend to overestimate their retirement income and underestimate their retirement expenses. So information is really the first of those three things that people need to pay attention to, and that's really what this series is all about. The second issue is you have to develop a financial plan, a plan into retirement, and of course we provide some resources, some ideas about how you can develop one of those. And then third is you have to have the self-discipline to stay the course and actually adhere to your plan. We're bombarded in society by messages from everywhere, commercials from our friends. You're not going to be happy unless you have the latest and greatest new product that's out, even though the one you may have works fine. And also to tend to buy things new as opposed to pick them up secondhand at a steep discount and save and invest the difference.
So going back to the first thing, information. And you mentioned, sort of a budget. I mean, is that just really just sitting down and looking at your budget?
Well, that's also a great question. I have often seen people recommend that people develop these complex, convoluted budgets. I actually have never met anybody that did that. The other approach is pay yourself first. So if you basically develop your spending habits such that you pay a substantial amount of your income to yourself first. And by that, I mean save it and invest it, say, in a diversified portfolio, work with a financial planner, or you can do it on your own, but make sure it's diversified and it's consistent with your goals, short-term, intermediate, and long-term. And everybody has goals or should have goals. Most Americans don't actually write them down, but you should. Yes, you could actually go through the exercise of budgeting every item. Very few people do that. The other way is pay yourself first and don't dig into those funds. You have to have the self-discipline to not do that.
So essentially, when I believe they're going to be announcing a new iPhone soon. So the new iPhone comes out. Don't dig into my retirement fund in order to purchase that new iPhone.
Exactly. Don't dig into your retirement fund for anything. And for somebody who's young, say 32, or I remember when I was 23, when I first graduated from university and went to work full-time, one of the issues that I had at that age was the word retirement was so distant. I actually was in the Canadian Air Force years ago in the height of the Cold War, and we expected to actually go get killed in World War III, and retirement was a distant concept for somebody that's 23.
Oh, for sure.
If somebody had explained it to me, say, in these terms, instead of, say, a individual retirement account, think of it as an insanely rich account. We're rich. For me, it's not about money as such. It's about freedom and independence. It's to be able to work because you want to, not because you have to. If you put it in those terms, even the power of the IRA, the individual retirement account, if you invest in a diversified portfolio over a very long period of time, using the correct knowledge and self-discipline, stick with it, that alone is enough to take care of your retirement. That's if you start at 23. Later on, there's even more powerful vehicles, of course, the 401k or for nonprofit employees such as the university, for example, or hospitals or in government, something called a 403b, which works the same. These things are incredibly powerful, and that's something that we cover in this series.
Well, so you mentioned working for a nonprofit or, you know, a state agency such as the university, which I am employed by the university. I really didn't start saving into retirement until I started working here. And so I was, you know, 29, 30. I mean, it's a really great program here. I mean, they match 10%. I put in the 10%. Am I on the right track?
Absolutely, but I would take it even a step further. The way the rules work, say, on a 403b plan, it's exactly the same as a 401k for a for-profit company. But with a 403b plan, say, I'm going to use round numbers. Say you made $100,000 a year. I'm not saying you do, but maybe
definitely
you do.
Definitely not. This is public radio.
Okay. But I'm just going to use it for round numbers. So say you made $100,000 a year and your employer had a 10% match. So if you put $10,000 in and your employer match is 10%, that means they're going to give you $10,000 into that account. So right off the bat, you've doubled your money. But it's better than that, because the $10,000 that you contributed to get the match is also tax deductible. So say you had a marginal, and it's the marginal tax rate that matters, the dollar you pay on each additional dollar of income that you make, because if you put that $1 into the 401k, then that's a dollar less that's taxed. So at the marginal rate, say if your tax rate federal was 28% and state is 7%, that's 35%. That's 35% you're going to save in taxes, get a refund back at tax return time. So really the $10,000 you put in only cost you $6,500. Now, is this exciting? Before we even start talking about taking risk in the markets, if you put in enough to get that employer match, do you realize you have tripled your money before you even take any risk? And then, of course, somebody like me, I'm going to be starting to take risk in the stock market, real estate investment trusts, master limited partnerships, all kinds of different things, sometimes bonds if bonds look attractive, and then take risks to grow that money that's in there. But think about that. We've tripled our money before we take any risk. Most Americans don't even put enough to get the match. And with a 401k, actually, for somebody like myself over 50, we're talking about the ceiling you can contribute is not just 10% of your income, depending on how much you might make, but it's actually $23,000 per year. So say you made the $100,000, you take the you put in your $10,000 to get that match, but you can still put another $13,000 in, and remember that $13,000, you still only pay 65% of it, so you're going to greatly reduce your taxes and increase your retirement savings that way. With the university, we even have something called a 457 salary deferral plan that allows you to put another $23,000 in that's tax deductible. And in these vehicles, 401k, 403b, 457 plan, not only are your contributions tax deductible, but you have tax deferred growth. That means you don't pay taxes on the growth that you make every year.
Sounds like a pretty good deal.
It's a great deal.
Yeah.
some people call it loopholes. There's no such thing as a loophole. Congress passed these by design.
Right.
I believe it's every taxpayer's duty to pay the minimum amount of tax they can legally pay. And that way you can invest. Look after your retirement, which is really something we're going to increasingly have to do ourselves.
All right. And so the three things: information, financial plan,
and self-discipline.
And self-discipline.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
Finance. It's where the money is.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Rainey.
Thank you.
It is Sunday, September 15th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Good morning. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oh, it's one of my favorite times of year.
Fall?
Mid-September.
Bikes, blues, and barbecue.
Oh.
It's the last time we'll be able to hear each other for a while.
It's earlier than it has been.
Football.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to dodge football.
You can't have bikes, blues, and barbecue and a Razorback football game.
That would just be a ton of people.
It'd just blow up.
Right.
I love this quote. What's Up music editor Kevin Kinder talked to Joe Giles. He said, "We love things that move, and if they move loudly, we really love it."
Well, we're going to have a good diet of that for the next few days.
Absolutely beautiful. You know what's new this year?
What? I don't.
An air show.
Bikes fly now?
Bikes fly now. It's called Bikes, Blues, and Bombers.
Okay.
And it's the commemorative Air Force, which used to be the Confederate Air Force.
Uh-huh.
And they're bringing in a B-29 Super Fortress.
Is that what I flew in?
It is indeed what All you right. flew in. I flew in one of those 20 years ago.
This is allegedly the only one flying right
yeah.
now.
I can believe that.
They're old.
Yes. Don't think about that when you're up in that.
Oh, well, it's hard not to.
Think about how old that bolt is.
If we get a chance to go up, I want to go. That would be so much
you
fun.
You should do it.
I've been up in a hot air balloon and in a dirigible.
This is louder. I guarantee you
I'm
that.
Sure it is.
This is louder.
As is everything else, they're expecting 500,000 bikers. Well, 400,000, really. What does the other 100,000 matter?
And those numbers have always kind of been, let's face it, no one really
yeah.
knows.
No.
If I had to put money on it, I'm going to bet it's fewer than that. Well, it's going to be enough, but I bet it's fewer than
if
that.
If you count, okay, let's imagine I had a bike.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ride down from Rogers, and I go one day, and I go
sure.
back to Rogers, and
sure.
I come back another day, I'm two people. And then if I come back a third day, I'm three people.
But we do know that those numbers, let's face it, have been, I'm not saying in the recent past, but in the past they have been inflated.
Well, there's going
that's,
to be
still
last
year
a
didn't
lot of
seem
people.
That busy.
Yeah. Well, they have spread it out as well.
True.
And
we
they,
digress.
Of course, are going to have the Parade of Power, which is at 4 o'clock on the 21st. The Battle of the Bikes, which is the morning of the 21st at the intersection of Dixon and West Avenue. And the inaugural Bike Games, which happened at the Washington County Fairgrounds. They competed in events such as a slow ride contest, a keg push, and more.
Now, what is a slow ride? This is intriguing. The slow ride is what?
I don't have a clue.
Go as slow as you can?
I think without stopping or falling over. It's something like that.
I know the silliest thing I saw at Sturgis, and yes, I have been to Sturgis once, was a burnout contest where apparently you try to leave the entire tire of your bike on the pavement.
Not endorsed by many environmental groups.
I don't understand, but it doesn't matter.
That's right.
Music starts Wednesday. Beer Garden opens at 3. Music starts Wednesday night with Foley's Van, Sarah Hughes, the Ben Miller Band, and Mountain Sprout. And we'll keep you updated through the week as the insanity grows.
And one of the most exciting things for those of us here is just walking distance away, festival food.
Funnel cakes and corn dogs.
There you go.
Barbecue food.
And deep fried Snickers bar.
And I think we'll have a song coming up from Foley's Van.
That's
actually.
Right, coming up on this program, mm-hmm. yes.
Excellent. All right, this afternoon, there is an orchid auction hosted by the Orchid Society of the Ozarks.
Much quieter than bike
Much
and
quieter.
Barbecue.
Starts at noon at Northwest Technical Institute in Springdale.
Yes.
I'm being quiet now. There is also a live on stage concert, the first one of the season.
Exile.
With Exile at 2 o'clock at Aaron Dart Center in Bentonville. Tickets are $25 for adults. Classical Edge Theater's Julius Caesar. Remember, it's down to 75 minutes. Catch it before it's down to 10. 2 o'clock at Gully Park in Fayetteville. And an art auction and concert starting at 2:30 at KJ's Carib Restaurant in Eureka Springs. It is, of course, a fundraiser for Save the Ozarks.
I don't think you can get any more varied than what we just talked about.
I agree.
We'll try.
Okay.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Thursday, September 19th. will be National Talk Like a Pirate Day.
One of my new favorite things to do is to look at the interesting days that are coming up in the next week.
This one's been around for a while. It's been featured on NPR and in the New York Times, and it is what it says it is. It's the day you're supposed to talk, I don't know, like an actual pirate, but talk like the pirates that became popular in fiction.
Right.
With that in mind, our montage salutes pirates in fiction.
The very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fight's historical. From Marathon to Waterloo, in order categorical.
Eureka! At last, I, Jean Lefoot, the barefoot pirate, have my very own breakfast cereal.
Fiddle fool, Lefoot. You haven't had a winner yet.
Yo, ho, yo, ho, a pirate's life for me. We kill every plunder, we rival, and look, bring up behind you, ho.
Mr. Gibbs, any particular reason why my ship is gone?
The ship? We're on the ship. Jack! The ship's gone. Really?
Well, well. A codfish on a hook.
I'll get you for this plan. If it's the last thing I do.
Yes, I am a pirate. 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder. There's nothing to plunder. I'm an overboard victim of fate.
It's still a mystery.
Those guys are dorks.
Yes, but they're my dorks.
Begging your pardon, my lady, but might I make so bold as to say you're as wise as you be beautiful?
Stay your filthy tongue.
Hey, speaks.
'Tis the hate I have for Mendoza and all his black-hearted ilk what makes me offer you my services.
If you'd like to see the clips that will identify our fictional pirates, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com.
If you drive around Springdale, a name you'll find on signs throughout the town is Shiloh. But where does that name come from? As we continue our monthly What's in a Name series, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda investigates.
According to the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History's website, archaeologists believe people have lived in the area for about 12,000 years. The abundance of natural resources attracted the earliest people, and Osage Indians frequently used this area for hunting. The Cherokee Treaty of 1828 opened the area to settlers from eastern states. Susan Young, outreach coordinator for the museum, says the first established settlement in the Springdale area can be traced back to the 1830s, when there were just a few families living there. But by the 1840s, she says there were enough families living in the area to merit the need for a church.
They were all allied families in that if they weren't related by marriage, they had traveled here together from back east, and they all had the same worship, the Primitive Baptists. They were the old hard shell, foot washing Primitive Baptists. So they established a church around 1840, and the church name was Shiloh. Now, we've researched, and there's no definitive answer what is the Hebrew meaning of the word Shiloh. What I can say for certain is that it's a place in the Holy Land. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's a very sacred place where the Ark of the Covenant was stored for a time. So all that, what that gives us insight into is that picking the name of their church as Shiloh was kind of an auspicious name that the community, the few families that were here in 1840 were, church going was very much a part of their everyday lives. So the church and the community became known as one and the same within a few years. Shiloh.
Young says after the Civil War, settlers applied for a post office, but there was already another town in Arkansas named Shiloh with a post office. Young explains at that time there were no zip codes, so it would be difficult to know to which Shiloh a letter should be delivered. This resulted in the selection of a new name for the town, and Sarah Reed Meek is credited with coming up with Springdale.
But what she came up with, according to family lore, is Springs in the Dale, because of Spring Creek, which flows right through the downtown area, and it's fed by natural springs. Also, family lore has it that Sarah Meek heard her husband, who was one of the town leaders, and he was in on the discussion of what to name this town. What, we got to have a post office. What are we going to change our name to? And they went through several permutations of, well, let's name it after old Reverend Holcomb because he was one of the founders. Let's call it Holcombville. Or, well, what about Mr. Putman? He was important. Let's call it Putman Town. Or old Ann Huffmaster, Huffmasterville. So they went through all these names to honor early founders, and they couldn't agree on anything, is what the Reed family lore is. And so Sarah Reed Meek heard her husband coming home with this dilemma and reportedly said, why don't you name it Springs in the Dale? Just don't even name it for a person. And that was shortened to Springdale. And so we applied and became Springdale with a post office in 1872, and then the town was incorporated in 1878. So we've been Springdale ever since.
Several of those early founders have been honored by having streets named after them. Outreach coordinator Susan Young says Shiloh Museum staff members have been researching the Civil War because of the event's sesquicentennial, and what they've found is that soldiers referred to the area by yet another name. She says in most of the military records they've examined, they've found people referring to the little community as Holcomb Spring, a nod to the John and Dorothea Holcomb family. Susan explains the family owned a lot of land in the area, and John was a preacher in the Shiloh Church. Though the original Shiloh Church no longer exists, the third one does. The building is located on the Shiloh Museum grounds, and Young says they hope to eventually restore its interior so it can be used. Although Springdale was incorporated in 1878, Young says the name Shiloh still appeared into the early 1900s. In the 1920s and 30s, Young says stories from the sports page of the Fayetteville newspaper often mentioned playing the boys from Shiloh. The museum opened years later in 1968, and planners made the decision to incorporate Shiloh into its name.
You can look back in old newspaper articles about plans for a Springdale City Museum, but now I think from the get-go, the people who founded the museum, and I think from the word go, it's going to be the Shiloh Museum. It was the Shiloh Museum of Springdale at first, and then as we kind of set about what is our mission, what story do we want to tell, we refined it to be the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History. Well, that's really not refining it. We broadened it to say we're the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, meaning we're going to tell the story of the Arkansas Ozarks.
Of course, that's just one example of the prevalence of the word Shiloh in Springdale today. Another example is Shiloh Christian School, which, according to its website, was founded in 1976 as a ministry of the First Baptist Church of Springdale. Other examples include Shiloh Square, the Shiloh Sacred Harp Singers, and, of course, Shiloh Street. Though it has been more than a century since the town was officially named Springdale, why does the Shiloh name remain?
I think in Springdale, there's a strong sense of roots, and that Shiloh harkens back to the sense of the community's history. I mean, you know, you have the largest museum in the history museum in the region located in Springdale, and that's just a nod to the importance that the community has placed on its history over the years. So Shiloh is just, it just continues to be an important sense of place for Springdale, I think. Maybe not so much now. I mean, there's plenty of people now that don't have any idea about Shiloh being the original name of Springdale. So that's kind of our mission, is to help honor those early community founders by recognizing and remembering that name, Shiloh.
For more information on Springdale history, you can visit shilohmuseum.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The bluegrass and old-time band Foley's Band recently stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF, and they played us several songs, including this one, Call My Name.
One, two, ready, and...
Band will perform Wednesday at 4 on the main stage during this week's Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue in Fayetteville.
The AMP Arkansas Music Pavilion presents Vampire Weekend with guest Sky Fiera Wednesday, September 25th. This foursome from New York City is frequently featured on NPR's music scene, including First Listen and Live in Concert. Tickets and more information available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Crosses.
And let's see. Antoinette Grajeda will have a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large Daily Show tomorrow at noon.
She will.
And we'll have a full week of brand new shows, of course. And get ready for the motorcycles, because here they come.
I know. I can hear them already almost.
Wednesday, I believe, is the official start date for Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue in mostly Fayetteville, but throughout Northwest Arkansas.
I know, actually, Foley's Band, the band that we just heard from, is playing in Eureka Springs on Thursday evening, yeah. I think at 5 at the Cat House.
Right.
So I know a lot of bikers like to go to Eureka. So
All right. Ozark's larger production of KUF and Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Have a great weekend.